G'day, humans! Few things in this world make people more uncomfortable than being made fun of. Nobody likes having the fun poked out of them, especially people who are powerful, I find, because the powerful sought to be powerful because they wanted to feel important and be respected by other people and be noticed. The last thing they want is for someone to bring them down a peg and point out that the emperor's wearing no clothes. Well, that's what I've spent much of my life trying to do, and it's what our guest today has devoted his to doing much better and with much more of a laser satirical focus than I. Mark Humphreys is well known to Australian audiences for his satirical sketches on the country's flagship current affairs program. He owns the sort of final 2 minutes of the week in which he takes a swipe at politicians. It's the sort of thing that might sound a little bit something like this.
In recent months, leaders at both a federal and a state level have been accused of passing the buck. To discuss accountability in politics, I'm joined now by the Federal Minister for the Buck. As Minister for the Buck, does the buck stop with you?
That's actually a common misconception. We are in a public health emergency, which means that buck responsibility actually transfers to the states.
So you're passing the buck onto state governments?
Well, for me to pass the buck on, I'd have to be in possession of the buck, which I'm clearly not, because the buck doesn't stop with me.
Then where has the buck stopped?
At the state border. The buck can't leave unless it is granted an exemption, which it won't be, since the buck won't stop with me.
That is Mark Humphreys on the 7:30 Report recently. It's a great tradition of Australian comedy to that sort of rapid fire political satire. He stands he walks in the footsteps of John Clarke and Brian Dore, who previously held that piece of television real estate. And he's a fascinating young guy. He is young. He's even younger than me. And I think of myself as being a wee babe in the woods, with a fascinating life story and fascinating insights into what social media and the political climate and the pace of news is doing to our brains. I hope that you enjoy this uncomfortable conversation as much as I enjoyed having it with the one and only Mark Humphreys.
So the relationship between siblings, and especially brothers, has always fascinated me since I used to go to tennis camps when I was like eight or something. Now, these two boys, I won't say their surnames.
No.
But these two boys...
You want to insure me for defamation.
These two boys, they had a reputation. They were the first kids you'd come across who swore. You
know? Were these the identical twins who killed everybody? Or
no,
was that, am I thinking
not,
of
were
a
not
bad telly
brothers,
movie?
No. Okay, right. No. So this is, anyway, so these two boys, I'll say their first names.
Okay.
But one of the first names is a definite giveaway.
Just make it up.
Okay.
It was Jason and Blayson.
All right, Jason and Blayson. Let's go with this. So Jason and Blayson, they were rough, okay? And
yeah.
Grew up in Crow's Nest, Sydney, northern suburbs, just very polite boy.
Yes.
And these kids were rough.
For non-Sydneysiders, this is a very effete.
That's it. It's a nice, prosperous, nice area.
Yeah.
Anyway, these kids were rough. And one of them was older. Let's say Jason was older and Blayson was younger.
No way you're keeping track of which one's which. No. I'm making notes, hang on.
Okay. So anyway, and what was fascinating is the way that Jason would talk down to Blayson all the time. He would always just go, Blayson, you're so fat. He would just rip into him. He was so cruel to his brother.
I think they're going to recognize themselves just from the impersonation.
That's right. And he would just rip into his younger brother. But as soon as some other kid would go, oh, yeah, Blayson, you're really fat, Jason would go, hey, that's my brother you're talking about.
Right.
And I thought, wow, that's interesting.
Well, that's true of all families, nations, faiths, any club,
sure.
Right? We can criticize
sure.
it, but you're not allowed to criticize us.
Yeah.
Like Aussies will be as self-deprecating about Australia and self-critical as you could possibly be.
Mm.
But the moment... a non-Australian says anything negative about Australia. Warren, you bloody go back to, you can go back to your bloody country then.
Well, I mean, I did Talking Pictures the other day with Mike Bowers, and there was Scott Morrison was in New Zealand. There was a New Zealand cartoonist had made fun of our Prime Minister.
Our Prime Minister.
I was suddenly a little offended.
Yeah,
that's a
of course.
Hey.
Exactly. I spend all my life doing nothing but lampooning him professionally.
I leave Jacinda alone. You have her, okay? How dare you?
So we were talking earlier about Norm Macdonald because you were saying that you'd seen a video on the electronic webs
and so you,
of me in conversation with the great Norm.
That's it.
Would have been from HuffPost Live.
Yes.
You were saying, how did I book him? Which is very sweet of you to ask.
To assume that you had some kind of power.
To assume that I had any control or influence over anything. No, when HuffPost Live was created in 2012, there was a huge amount of dot-com money for things like this. And the HuffPost brand was ascendant. And the HuffPost website was the most read online news website in the world. Online only. I mean, I'm sure BBC or something was more. But... and so when they said that they wanted to throw their hat in the ring and do 12 hours a day of video content, it went from, it went from 10 to 10 with the final 4 hours being done out of an LA studios because of the time difference. And so we were hosting like 4 to 6, 20 to 30 minute shows every single day.
Oh my God.
And so the bookers, so they had an army, so they had a lot of money, and they hired the best bookers who knew everybody, so they could get anyone. And it was also the cool place to come if you were a celebrity. Like you could do the morning shows, you could do Letterman, who might give you 8 minutes, but on HuffPost you got half an hour.
It looked very relaxed,
and it was live,
and comfortable.
Yeah, so you weren't likely to be taken out of context, although of course we tried our best. So people like Norm just came through. There was a period where people of that caliber were coming through quite regularly, and for some reason I think the clip of me and Norm survived the various takedowns of all of the copyright intellectual property disputes that were leveled against the HuffPost material, which you can't find now because the whole place got bought by America's largest telecommunications company. And we all know what a commitment to the creative arts executives at telecommunication companies have. So they did not look kindly on the cost of this enterprise and did not believe the sunny, rosy pictures for when it was going to reach profitability in the 2050s, presumably. And they took everything down.
But
and
Norm now they survived.
Norm survived somehow.
Yeah.
So there you have it. But that was a great great time and a great honor.
Was he one of the gets that you were really thrilled about? Was he someone you were already a fan of?
Yes, absolutely. Right. I mean, I remember when I was a little kid, I would tape Letterman on a VCR, on a VHS. And I would watch it back in the morning and create mixtapes of highlight reels of people like Norm.
Fantastic.
And he was he was just brilliant.
That's great. I used to tape McAuliffe Tonight when Sean McAuliffe had a Channel 9 show for 1 year.
An Australian comedian who now has a satirical show, but for a while had a talk show. And,
I think the story
is that he might be like a sort of a Jon Stewart for American listeners.
But at the ABC, he had the McAuliffe program, which is quite similar to Mad as Hell, and that's sort of largely a sketch program. But when Channel 9 poached him, apparently they said, so it'll be a variety show, so you can do your sketches and what have you, and obviously you'll do some interviews, but obviously you've done some interviews on your previous program. And Sean was like, yeah, but didn't you notice they were all played by Wayne Hope? Like,
they're all scripted sketches. Yeah.
So, suddenly Sean's thrown in having to interview people. And it was so funny. Like, his whole approach to interviews, like, was clearly just comedy first. Like, yeah, we'll get to whatever you're selling and whatever your anecdotes are, but just, like, how can we make something happen here? And I think sort of, one of the iconic moments for him was he had Danny Minogue on. I think it might have even been the first episode. And so Danny's got to sing her song, obviously.
This is Kylie Minogue's sister.
I'm not giving
sort
any context.
You've got to remember, our listeners are in America.
Yeah, she's Blayson's sister.
Yeah.
And
Blayson, Jason, Danny, Kylie.
So Danny Minogue is performing her new song, title unknown. And at a certain point during the song, they cut from Danny to Sean watching Enough Rope with Andrew Denton.
watching another competitor's interview show on a television.
Commitment to comedy. Total commitment to comedy. And I think my understanding is, of course, that then became an issue.
And Danny's people didn't
that. Don't do that.
That was what I loved about Letterman as well. I don't know if in the early days of his CBS show you were cognizant or alive but in the late 90s, he was so acerbic towards some guests.
I mean,
I just remember little things, like there was a supermodel, a South American supermodel who was on the show, who was just giving one word answers to everything.
Yes.
And he was like, "So what are you doing in your spare time?" And she goes, "Oh, I don't know. I like to eat." And he just lets the pause die and lets the audience start to titter and he picks up a pen and a piece of paper and starts taking notes. And he says, "So in addition to being a biological necessity, eating is a hobby for you."
Oh, God. Yeah. No, I think I've seen him say in numerous interviews that he just hated having to interview the newest, starlet.
But he didn't hide that, which is what was nice. So many of them try to make it seem like they're having fun.
Yes.
Fallon always has to be having fun with everybody. It's insufferable.
Yeah. Yeah. Letterman lent into the disdain.
Totally, totally. How did you get into this line of work, young man?
How did I get into this?
Why don't you describe your line of work?
Oh, sure.
How do you conceive of it?
Yes, okay. Well, so at the moment I do fortnightly satirical sketches for ABC's 7:30 program, which is a current affairs, news and current affairs
the
program.
The flagship
current affairs
program.
That's it.
In Australia.
Yes.
And it's like doing it for 60 minutes. Yeah. You're like Australia's Andy Rooney.
There's a reference.
100 years younger.
And so once a fortnight, they allow me to soil that program with whatever I want to do. And it's a program that has a history of, in the past, John Clark and Brian Dore had a satirical segment there for many, many years. And
they're the ones who did, some Americans will even know, the classic sketch about the front of the boat fell off.
Yeah.
Senator Collins, thanks for coming in.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
This ship that was involved in the incident off Western Australia this week.
Yeah, the one the front fell off?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not very typical. I'd like to make that point.
Well, how is it untypical?
Well, there are a lot of these ships going around the world all the time, and very seldom does anything like this happen. I just don't want people thinking that tankers aren't safe.
Was this tanker safe?
Well, I was thinking more about the other ones.
The ones that are safe?
Yeah, the ones the front doesn't fall off.
Well, if this wasn't safe, why did it have 80,000 tonnes of oil on it?
Well, I'm not saying it wasn't safe. It's just perhaps not quite as safe as some of the other ones.
Why?
Well, some of them are built so the front doesn't fall off at all.
Well, wasn't this built so the front wouldn't fall off?
Well, obviously not.
How do you know?
Well, because the front fell off and 20,000 tonnes of crude oil spilled into the sea caught fire. It's a bit of a giveaway. I just like to make the point that that is not normal.
Well, what sort of standards are these oil tankers built to?
Oh, very rigorous maritime engineering standards.
What sort of thing?
Well, the front's not supposed to fall off for a start.
And what other things?
Well, there are regulations governing the materials that they can be made of.
What materials?
Well, cardboard's out.
And?
No cardboard derivatives.
Like paper?
No paper. No string, no sellotape.
Rubber?
No, rubber's out. They've got to have a steering wheel. There's a minimum crew requirement.
What's the minimum crew?
Oh, one, I suppose.
So the allegations that they're just designed to carry as much oil as possible, hell with the consequences. I mean, that's ludicrous.
Absolutely ludicrous. These are very, very strong vessels.
So what happened in this case?
Well, the front fell off in this case, by all means, but it's very unusual.
But Senator Collins, why did the front book fall off?
Well, a wave hit it.
A wave hit it?
A wave hit the ship.
Is that unusual?
Oh, yeah. At sea. Chance in a million.
So what do you do to protect the environment in cases like this?
Well, the ship was towed outside the environment.
Into another environment?
No. It's been towed beyond the environment. It's not in the environment.
No, but from one environment to another environment.
No, it's beyond the environment. It's not in an environment. It has been towed beyond the environment.
Well, what's out there?
Nothing's out there.
Well, there must be something out
there. There is nothing out there. All there is sea and birds and fish.
And?
And 20,000 tonnes of crude oil.
And what else?
And a fire.
And anything else?
And the part of the ship that the front fell off. But there's nothing else out there.
Senator Collins, thanks for joining us.
A complete void.
Yeah, we're out of time.
Environment's perfectly safe. We're out of time?
Yeah.
Can you book me a cab?
But didn't you come in a Commonwealth car?
Yes, I did. But
what happened?
Well, the front fell off.
So that's their sketch.
Yeah, so that's what I do now. So I've been doing some version of political satire for, about 9 years now. And have been, quite good at it for maybe one or two.
I think you're very good at it. It's a funny thing because I could hear as you were trying to articulate what your job is, the difficulty with which people such as us have to explain what it is we do. Because you're like, well, at the moment, there's this one show that does this thing, but like, what do you write on the customs form when it asks what your occupation
exactly,
is?
Exactly, yes. So I think at the moment I tend to write writer, because I've got a book out. I've got a book coming out this month, so I can sort of, I have written, you know, other things. And so, but I think primarily that's what I enjoy doing, and I sort of perform out of necessity. It's really a budget thing. It's not that I'm, you know, deliberately imposing myself on audiences.
It is interesting that, and also writer has more cachet.
Yes, I think so.
You know, clown. What are you going to say?
No,
clown.
Exactly. That's it. Yeah.
I once had. I think I might have just told this on the podcast. So I beg. I beg listeners to be patient with me. But Mark may not have heard it. When I had a visa to go into the States, I had an O-1 visa, which is technically called an extraordinary talent.
Yes.
It's extraordinary talent. It's for foreign nationals. You know, it's the Russell Crowe visa or the Cate Blanchett visa, for sports people, entertainers, and scientists. Who are coming in to do a particular job. And so every time I would come in, it's a visa class that they don't see a lot of at the airport. And so you'd always get interesting questions or a raised eyebrow from the dumpling of a man at the customs immigration when you're getting off the plane in the States. And one time one of them looks at the little O-1 and he looks up at me and goes, "Extraordinary talent, huh?" And we just look at each other and he goes, "Well, you juggle."
Fantastic.
No, sir.
Have you ever had a scary time going through customs? Have you ever had a moment where you went, "I'm not sure I'm
very
going through
much
this"?
So many, yeah. Many times. Because weirdly, I made the decision to go to Egypt right during the revolution.
Oh, right.
And
for a holiday.
It was not exactly it's a long story. I'm like a travel hacker who uses tricks out the frequent flyer programs of airlines.
Suddenly flights were really cheap and all these hotel rooms were available. I don't know why. I didn't bother to look into it.
What actually happened was you can buy round the world airfares for a fixed price, which give you up to 20 flights around the world, and there are slightly arcane rules about where you can go, but you can basically go all the way around the world for a single flat fare. And the business class versions of these airfares are usually something in the range of like $10,000 or something, so they're quite expensive, but comparatively not that expensive when you think about all of the constituent flights, given how expensive flying in the nose of the plane is. I was doing a lot of domestic flying in the States, and in the States, not so much anymore, but 5 or 10 years ago, having top tier status was really valuable because they give unlimited domestic upgrades to people who are like platinum, status. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to maintain my status, which you have to get by flying 100,000 miles in a year. So I thought, it'd be great if I could, and you get a whole bunch of the bonus status credit things if you're at the front of the plane. If you're in business class or first class, you'd never get there in economy. But if you can fly around the world, once around the world, if you kind of make it work so that you're going on really long, obscure journeys.
I feel like you've built your entire life about just maintaining status.
I have. It was all just about making sure that I never fell below the status where you get the lounge access, at least. So anyway, I had this whole thing mapped out. Like if I use one of the domestic trips to go to Alaska, then that's a long way. So then I'll get my status. So I had it all mapped out. I was like, now I just have to find a jurisdiction in the world where the round-the-world airfare is priced disproportionately cheaply. In other words, somewhere where the currency has just collapsed. So I can, parlay the international currency arbitrage in my favor. So the Egyptian pound had fallen through the floor. I was like, this is what I'll do. I'll just use some miles to go to Cairo, and I'll start the trip there, buying my ingenious round the world business class flight from Cairo. And so I went there. I spent a night in Cairo. I almost got kidnapped by Islamists in Tahrir Square. Seriously, it was one of the most frightening experiences of my life.
This is already a better answer than I was anticipating.
This is even better. I got rescued by a young bilingual student who translated between me and the Islamists who were not letting me leave the throng in the square. There were military aircraft flying overhead with the Egyptian colors being sprayed out the back.
But that was just to maintain their status points.
I was like, why are they up there? How do you get on those planes? I bet those lounges are ace. So then the young student who was rescuing me was like, the gentleman is asking you to come with him, but I frankly, if I were you in your shoes, I would politely decline his offer. So I did, and he took me back to his hotel, and the next day I flew out. When I arrived back in the States for the subsequent 3 or 4 years, I never didn't get put into secondary screening every single time I came back.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, yeah, right.
So always took at least 3 to 4 hours of sitting in a room waiting for them to do all kinds of background checks and then grilling me about this and grilling me about
that.
Gosh,
okay, you're on the list.
Yeah, right. On the list. So that one way I'd rather... Man,
but
the lounges were great.
But the lounges, though.
The lounges. Gosh. I got to tell you.
Yeah. So there's just a little asterisk next to the thing about the lounge access. Yeah. It's a tiny thing.
Please note. Okay, so you got into political satire in the first place by doing what?
Well, I was interning on a daily news comedy show that had just sort of started up. It was a two-minute show. I mean, this is not even a thing, a two-minute show, but it was on ABC2 Comedy Channel. I think it aired at 7:28 or something.
I mean, it was just ahead of its time because everything's 2 minutes
now,
these days. The kids with their Twitch and their TikTok.
That's right. Exactly.
You were ahead
of time.
It
seemed like, well, this is ridiculous. And so we were doing that. And so I was just interning on that. And I just sort of kept interning until they put me on the payroll. And at first that show was sort of like, oh, what's funny in the news today? You know, we've only got 2 minutes. Like, oh, Justin Bieber's done something ridiculous. Or, oh, this new song, you know, Gangnam Style. Let's do something about that. But over time, as you're reading the newspaper every single day, you start going, oh, there's some quite important things going on. And some of these things feel like they're perhaps more worthy of being lampooned than, you know, the latest pop sensation from Korea. So it was over time, just like you just naturally start to become, you know, fairly relatively well informed, I would say.
And had you been a news junkie?
Not
in your teens, were you a news junkie?
Not even close. Oh. Not even close. I had no interest in politics.
You seem like the sort of guy who was.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad I give that impression.
Yeah.
I put a lot of work into that. But I had no interest in it. The story I always tell is that my parents were politically, they were on, you know, opposite sides of the spectrum. I don't mean far left or far right. I just mean like, you know, one more progressive.
Okay. When you said opposite ends of the spectrum, I in my brain there was like someone in it with a swastika armband doing goose stepping, and then another with a cartoon communist sign.
Sure, yeah.
Buxom wench harvesting grain.
Yeah. Actually, that reminds me, though. I have an idea. No, actually, I have an idea that this is the one show that I could discuss it on, but will I do it? But anyway, but yeah, let's narrow that spectrum.
Go with that idea.
I've got this idea. I think it's a satirical idea.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's something. There's an app in the style of Tinder. I haven't given it a name yet, but for argument's sake, we'll call it
Blinder.
We'll call it
and Jason Blayson.
We'll call it Hate Fucker. And basically, it's you put in your political stance, and then they match you up with people on the opposite end of the spectrum, because I think those people would like to hate fuck each other.
Yes.
You know, it's just like, you know what, you're gorgeous, you're hot, what have you, I hate everything about what
I
you
love
believe
this.
Let's get it on. I
love
think there's
it.
Actually something,
the vegan and the hunter.
Yeah,
can
right.
you imagine?
Sure, exactly.
It doesn't have to be political. It's
exactly.
cultural.
That's it.
Yes.
That's
the woke it. I mean, don't get us started on trans issues and the transphobes.
So
sometimes often that's the thing.
Is that,
you know,
a thing?
Yes.
Oh, gosh.
And like, you
okay.
know, closeted gay people who are super homophobic, the pastor.
Right. Yep, sure.
You know, and the gay Mardi Gras, the guy who rides the giant inflatable cock down Oxford Street in the Mardi Gras.
Go for it.
They don't call this uncomfortable conversations for nothing. I can see you squirming already.
No! He said cock!
I can't get away with this. It's 7:58 in the evening. That's my pitch. Actually, yeah, part of me thinks it actually is a good idea.
It actually is a good idea because I think a lot of it...
Opposites attract, they say.
Raw animal sex is that.
Right, yes.
It's just that we don't factor that in. Well, or maybe the geniuses at Match.com do and we don't know about it.
I got the idea from George... Well, they didn't give it to me. I didn't speak to him. But it was inspired by George and Kellyanne Conway. Is that... Because I would see people say, man, they must have amazing sex. It must be... That must be what it is. Because, like, clearly... He's out during the Trump administration. He was out there on Twitter bashing Trump every single day. And every day she's got to go out there and say, everything's hunky-dory.
I just assumed they lived in different houses and slept in different beds. But this is a nice spin.
But I like
on
the
it.
Idea
like
that
the
actually
idea
they're really actually quite rock solid.
Yeah. I like it.
And having amazing sex. So that's thank you. Yeah, that George and Kellyanne have inspired this.
I'm not sure I wanted the image of George and Kellyanne having sex
it's beautiful
in my brain.
It's beautiful in its own way.
Is
Josh,
it?
Don't
really?
Judge.
So you had this 2-minute program.
Yeah. And now you run Hate Fucker, right?
Yeah, that's right, exactly. Is it lucrative, the Hate Fucker app? How do you monetize that? Yeah, how do you monetize that exactly?
So anyway, so we did the 2-minute program. That then expanded to a massive 10 minutes a night. Yeah.
And what was this program called?
So called The Roast.
Do I remember this? The Roast. Yes. Right.
And anyway, so did a 10-minute version of that for a couple of years. And within that time, I then sort of carved out a niche. I had a little sort of rapid-fire headlines segment at the top of the show, which is very much inspired by Norm Macdonald, because I really felt like, oh, it'd be nice if, because we're trying to do big stories and deep dives in the way that you would see, I guess now you would see on like Last Week Tonight with John Oliver or what have you. But I sort of felt like, is there a way that we can just do short stories where it's just bam, bam, joke, 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 you know,
based
set
on
up punchline
the,
or whatever.
When
know.
Norm was doing the Weekend Update
exactly.
on SNL.
That's it. Yeah. And because the show was so short, just kind of doing it in a kind of rapid fire, like, Prime Minister Tony Abbott today has announced to me and that kind of thing. And it sort of developed a little tiny bit of a reputation. And then the show ended. And then The Guardian picked that segment up for a series of web videos. And then after that, the feed at SBS called me up and said, oh, do you want to come and do, you know, your shtick over here? And then it sort of evolved into doing, yeah, satirical kind of sketches. Did that for a couple of years and then eventually got asked whether I'd like to join 7:30. So it's been about 9 years that I've, that through line of political comedy.
And this is a stupid question because I always hate it when people ask me, but where do you get your ideas from? Like, I mean, I remember my first job, as some listeners will know, was doing satire and political comedy on Mike Carlton's show on 2UE when The Chaser left there and they got their ABC TV show. They had been mentors/idols of mine, a sort of half generation older than me at uni. Right. And so I then slipped in and like pitched myself to Carlton because I knew that they were leaving. And I did a good John Howard. And that was about enough for Mike Carlton at the time.
That's all you needed.
That was all you needed. It was a good John Howard impression. Yeah. And eventually worked up a bunch of different voices. But the writing of the like, it's quite hard to not make satire obvious because everyone's got their initial satirical take on any public figure.
Yes.
And so I would inhale a lot of, like, letters to the editor, a lot of editorial cartoons, a lot of op-ed articles to try to piece together, like, what is the kernel of hypocrisy that is interesting to attack this week or today?
Yes.
And then, as I'm going at it, how do I not make the audience know what's coming a split second before it's about to land and then make it something that's interesting? What the improv people in New York would call going from A to D instead of from A to B.
Right. Sure.
Do you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, just quickly. So Charles Firth, who founded The Chaser, he created The Roast. So that was my sort of. So I've done a lot of stuff with Charles since.
So we are both children.
We're children of Charles.
Children of Charles.
That's it.
That'll be the name of the telly movie.
Yeah, you've seen Children of the Corn.
Yes, this is Children of Charles.
And so where do ideas come from? I mean, obviously, yes, consuming a lot of news, which is something also that when we're not on air, I immediately stop doing. I don't know if you are
I do as well. No, I turn off. But I think largely that's because of social media. Before social media, I read the newspaper every day and I consumed news. Now it's so fast.
Yes.
That I've pulled back when I'm not on the air.
That's it.
And I take the attitude of if it's not important enough to be in The Economist or the weekend papers, I don't need to worry about it.
Yes. Well, I mean, this is something we may end up getting onto, but like, yeah, because Twitter's a big part of my life and it's a big sort of reason for me doing this work that I'm doing now is that I've had success. My sketches have done well on Twitter, and that's helped me build an audience. But Twitter has simultaneously been the best thing for my career and the worst thing for my mental health.
Yeah.
And one of the things I can't stand, and part of the reason that I switch off when I don't need to watch it, is that there seems to have been a culture has developed where a lot of people feel like they need to weigh in on whatever the story of the day is. There's this sort of something will come up and suddenly everyone has a take on it. Now, I'm not saying they shouldn't. I'm just saying it's a lot to take in of suddenly, an example last week, I'm sorry, I'm taking us on a side tangent. I'll eventually answer your question.
This is the whole point of the show. This show is entirely side tangents, if you haven't noticed.
But like there was a thing last week where there was this thing about the Australia Club. This I think it's a men's only club, some sort of elite thing. I'd never heard of it. And then suddenly they were having a vote to decide whether or not they should let women enter. And it was a funny thing where suddenly...
The vote failed, fortunately, in case any listeners are worried that there were ladies dragging their malodorous...
And it's the sort of thing, and it's a sort of, it's a weird thing where like I sort of think, oh, men's only, it seems a bit okay. And so I sort of went, oh, I'm sure they'll vote to allow women in, but it was, and then of course they didn't. But it was the thing where suddenly everyone had an opinion on this thing that a day earlier I'd never heard of. And I think I don't want to live like that. I don't want to suddenly go from no awareness of something to too much awareness of something. Yes. And that too much awareness suddenly gives it a weight that I'm not sure it deserves.
Yeah.
And like the day before that, you know, Peter Credlin, who had been the chief of staff to Tony Abbott, she was awarded an Order of Australia, which I don't know what an American equivalent of an Order of Australia.
Presidential Medal of Freedom, maybe?
Something like that, And so, but they hand out a lot of these. And
it's what used to be a knighthood, kind of. Well, no, that's the highest level. AM is probably what a knight was.
Right. And so anyway, she receives this award along with a bunch of other people. And that's then the story of the day because she's not, you know, she's not popular, certainly in progressive circles. And I just like, even though, you know, if I were on the board, I'm probably, you know, she's not the first name that comes to mind of who I'd.
But these people get nominated as well. That's the thing that I always don't understand about people getting angry about people getting awards. Mm. Like somebody from the community, and admittedly, it might be her cat. We don't know who does the nominating. It could be, you know, someone who's totally partisan. But nonetheless, the person gets nominated, and then your job as the person who's deciding whether or not to give the award is, are the criteria fulfilled?
Yes.
Like,
yes.
Has this person made a contribution? That's and it. Just because you don't like the person's politics doesn't mean that they didn't make a contribution to public life.
Yes.
You know, like,
yes, exactly.
That's what I sort of don't get about people getting angry about people receiving awards just because they came from the wrong party.
Yeah. So I kind of, you know, like I say, I wouldn't have given her an award, but she may have.
But maybe you would have. If the nomination had come across your desk and you'd looked at the criteria and you'd gone, has this person.
I wouldn't have nominated. I think I probably wouldn't have nominated.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, but suddenly, you know, then that unleashes, you know, thousands of tweets. And it's a weird thing where even though I might instinctively go, oh, yeah, I'm not sure if that's someone I would put forward, suddenly I now hear thousands of people echoing some version of my own sentiment, but then actually sometimes maybe even being much more vitriolic. And I'm now going, I don't know if I feel that way anymore.
No,
I'm
exactly.
now retreating.
Yes. Now that you've articulated my position in such an obnoxious way, I'm going to retreat from it.
That's it.
I feel that all the time. I mean, I feel that about all political persuasions and all thought movements.
I think that's something I find heartbreaking sometimes is I'll see something where I go, I absolutely agree with what you've just said. I think you've articulated that in the worst possible way and have actually damaged the movement by doing it.
Did you see that piece about like the sort of woke, censorious, finger wagging left about how insufferable they are even to people on the left? And I'm trying to remember what the sketch was. Anyway, I'll insert it or something.
Who is to blame for making neo-Nazis look like the new rock and roll punk? And the answer is, unfortunately, partly us. Don't get me wrong, I love left-wing values and hope that one day they'll win out across the globe. It's just that on that day, I don't want any actual left-wing people to be alive to see it happen. Why? Because we're fucking useless. I mean, first of all, Brexit. What the fuck happened there?
Well, the left employed a cunning two-prong strategy by, one, calling every Leave voter a racist, and two, failing to put forward a positive case for Remain.
Right. Weird how not engaging 17 million Brits and slagging them off instead didn't win them over. But at least yelling RACIST online made us feel good about ourselves and had no bad, long-lasting side effects.
The UK has voted to leave the European Union.
Ah, shit. Well, don't worry. After Brexit, we learnt our lesson. And then the US election came along, we thought, nah, let's just do that again.
You could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables.
Not surprisingly, the left's campaign of vote for us, you pieces of shit, didn't pan out so well.
got, oh, I don't know what I said, ah.
But don't worry, it's not just the big battles. The left are totally useless on a small scale as well. This is largely thanks to the foul brick of nightmares we all have sewn into our hands, which means we're also bleeding woke all the time, that we find something new to be offended by every few seconds. Just for example, the movie Dunkirk is sexist, using the word wife is offensive, this cute kid is a massive racist, doctors saying your weight isn't healthy is fat-shaming, Halloween costumes are a microaggression, Mark Twain is racist, in fairness he is 183 years old, we should have seen it coming, and practicing yoga is cultural genocide. Again, not quite the big picture issues the left used to be famous for.
That was Jazz Twemlow, a brilliant lefty comic, in a sketch he did for the final week of the ABC comedy program, Tonightly with Tom Ballard. Like, can't you just make the same points without being a dick?
Yeah, and I think, and like you say, I think it's all sides. I think it happens both ways. So there are, yeah. So yeah, that's my struggle with is Twitter is just, I've always thought ideally there'd be some sort of a cap, sort of saying, all right, the big topic today is Peter Credlin has been awarded an Order of Australia. We're taking 20 tweets on this, and that's it.
Yeah,
that's it. We're not doing anymore. All. And if your point has already been made by one of these other 20 tweets, you can't. Unless you've got a radical new take,
We're
going to go with one of the 20 tweets that exist. So,
Would it be a first come, first served on 20 tweets? Or I mean, is there some quality control?
I guess just like
in the Humphreys dictatorship.
Like, yeah, exactly. Just like the Order of Australia, you'd have to nominate someone to nominate the tweet. And there'd be a whole thing.
That does already exist. It's called the op-ed pages of a newspaper.
Right, yes, sure.
Where there's an editorial control over who gets to have their opinion heard.
So anyway, I now have to walk back my comments because obviously I want to encourage everyone to be engaged and to make a contribution.
You don't have to pretend. That's all right. You don't have to pander to my audience.
But I
have mature enough listeners to understand that we sometimes don't want to hear from them.
It's more just like, maybe I just need to work out how to use the platform differently. But
no, the platform's broken and your criticisms are completely legit. No, there's no, we were not built to have performative opinions constantly sort of policed or applauded by our peers in real time in the aggregate. Like, this is an insane way to be communicating with each other.
Yeah. So, but you know, that said, you know, I'm also obviously I'm someone who's fortunate enough to have a large platform to put together some version of my take on things. So, you know, I don't want to be discouraging people from having their take on it, but I think sometimes it's the things that seem to me relatively small that suddenly seem big by the sheer sort of, I suppose, I don't know, boredom of Twitter.
Do you think you're a contrarian by nature?
No, I don't.
Is it that you see the herd stampeding in one direction and therefore you feel the need to go in another direction?
I don't think so much that I feel the need to go in the other direction, but just maybe I feel slightly anxious when I see it all, them going all in. Yeah, I don't know if I'd go completely the other way, but I probably just step back.
Right, step to the side a little bit.
Step to the side. And I just don't participate. Occasionally, if I feel like I've got some, you know, clever observation to make, but a lot of the time I'll just observe because it's more noise.
But it's also kind of fruitless to actually participate, in my experience. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm just too much of a shit stirrer, but if I'm going to communicate in any way that isn't going to get me into more trouble than it's worth, then I'm going to be saying something that other people have said, and it's a fairly predictable thing to say. So I might as well not say the thing that's not going to get me into trouble.
And if I'm
going to say the thing that's going to get me into trouble, then why bother?
Yes. I mean, maybe that's what it should be, is that ideally the algorithm would be so clever that you tweet something and there might be a little warning, because I think there's now, if you want to share a news article, it might say, hey, just check, you know, have you read the article?
It's quite passive aggressive. It says, would you like to read the article before you tweet it, you fuckhead?
But I'd love the algorithm to develop to a point where it can actually detect how many other people have articulated this point of view and just maybe go, would you like to retweet that person?
Yes, that's good. Your point has been made by 143,622,582 people, of whom 32% made it better than you.
Yeah. So that's the weird thing, because obviously, like, because in terms of like a movement, or in terms of people en masse opposing something, that's actually quite powerful to suddenly see if you're in your timeline, bam, 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 all these people, you know, coming out against something. But I think it's when it's the thing that to me at least seems relatively trivial, like an award in that case.
But even if it's big, does that like, does that change the equation?
Well, I think I don't want to equate it to marching, but it's almost like a digital march. If suddenly you see person after person speaking out against something, maybe for instance, like the Bilawila family, I think that's something that's been, you know, quite useful.
Do you want to explain that?
Oh, sure. So this is a Tamil family from Sri Lanka who had come to Australia and then had, so a husband and wife, they came here. I'm not fully across the whole.
I mean, they came here illegally by boat, and then as a result of Australia's harsh treatment of people who arrive illegally by boat. Well, it's not illegal if you're a genuine refugee. I shouldn't say that. They came in an undocumented fashion by boat, and then they've been languishing, rotting on a desert island that we sent them to, I believe, on Christmas Island, right?
Yes.
For several years now, and one of the daughters got sick, and so she had to come to the mainland for medical evacuation, but it took too long and the government was dragging its feet and they were regarded as being overly harsh, and this all feeds into the general Australian soul searching about how cruelly we treat people who arrive by boat.
Yes, and so the family have now been reunited, but they're in Perth, so they're kind of on the Australian mainland, but they're still in community detention. They can't go back to the community that wants them back. So it's still, that's an ongoing thing. But I guess what I'm trying to say is I probably saw about as many tweets about that as I did about Peter Credlin. And that's what I think is, that's where I kind of go. I don't know how we kind of modify that, because clearly the welfare of this family is infinitely more important than a certificate that, you know, Tony Abbott's former chief of staff.
Oh, it's not just a certificate. She gets a little brooch as well. Okay. It's a pin on her lapel.
Right. Okay. And then she gets a little sale of the century pin and a pen and all sorts of other prizes. But yeah, so that's what I'm trying to say is that I think Twitter sometimes ends up with this situation where things that are not equal of importance almost appear to be by the sheer quantity of discussion around them.
Also, don't people posture and pretend to care about things more than they actually care about them? I mean, isn't that, you're reminding me a little bit, I saw recently a clip of Jordan Peterson on Q&A a few years ago, mm-hmm. where a young girl asked him whether or not how he can defend his attitude, his advice to young people to clean their rooms and get their own house in order before they start taking on big global issues, because aren't there pressing global issues that need our attention right now, like climate change? And his response was basically that generally there's a lot that people are running from about themselves, mm-hmm. and there's a lot that we don't want to deal with in our real lives. And a logical psychological response to that is to grasp for grand missions that we can accomplish, where we cast ourselves as the hero mm-hmm. of our own story. Mm-hmm. And instead of doing the grind and the shit of cleaning up our own messes in our own locality, we can make ourselves feel good about ourselves and look good to our neighbors and family mm-hmm. by taking on big issues.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether social media isn't just becoming a forum for that as well. So everything becomes a big noble cause for you to score a virtue point about, whether it's Peter Credlin or whether it's the Bilawila family. It doesn't really matter. It's an opportunity for you to not have to clean your room.
My experience has been that people can do a tremendous amount of good for themselves and for the people who are immediately around them by looking to their own inadequacies and their own flaws and the things that they're not doing in their lives, and starting to build themselves up as more powerful individuals. And if they're capable of doing that, and then they're capable of expanding their career. And if they're capable of expanding their career and their competence, then they're capable of taking their place in the community as effective leaders. And then they're capable of making wise decisions instead of unwise decisions when it comes to making collective political decisions. I'm not suggesting in the least, and have never suggested, that there's no domain for social action. I'm suggesting that people who don't have their own houses in order should be very careful before they go about reorganizing the world, which happens in many ways. So,
if a young person believes that the climate, the global warming problem on the climate is something that needs to be tackled quickly, and they can't wait until they grow up and become prime ministers to do it, Do you think collective responsibility overrides individual responsibility in a huge issue like that?
No.
Okay.
I don't. Okay. I think that generally people I think generally people have things that are more within their personal purview that are more difficult to deal with and that they're avoiding, and that generally the way they avoid them is by adopting pseudo-moralistic stances on large-scale social issues so that they look good to their friends and their neighbours. That's what it looks like.
So when I see all these tweets, I should imagine, man, that person's room must be so
terrible. Dirty.
My gosh.
Disgusting.
If only they would devote that energy to something in their immediate vicinity.
Do you find that it's distracting you from things that you'd be better off doing, social media?
I think I've gotten better.
Do you have the app on your phone?
I do. Mm. I do.
Did you ever get rid of it?
I did. I've had periods where it was there and wasn't there. Absolutely.
It's good not having it there. It's good having to go to a computer and type in www.twitter.com.
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, and I'm quite envious of people who tell me that they deleted the app. But the way I justify it to myself is that I do think I need it for work. I do need to be aware of what the conversation is. I think it's useful to see what at least some of the sentiment is around certain issues and what is an issue that, you know, yeah, people are interested in, because I've also got to be appealing to, you know, because sometimes I'm backtracking on this now. One of the interesting challenges I have sometimes, sorry, maybe it's not interesting at all, interesting to me.
I'll be the judge of that.
Yeah.
I have my gavel at the ready.
But like, do you want to do a piece of comedy about something that everyone's talking about so that you're kind of tapping into that conversation? Or do you want to highlight something that you think is worth satirizing but isn't really being talked about? And you'll see in the response, you'll see in the maybe it's a reflection of the quality of what I've made, but just sometimes it's just like, you know, there's going to be a muted response to me talking about secret trials involving Witness K. This is a whole thing for international audiences. It will mean nothing. It might even mean nothing to Australian audiences. But like that's a story that is still kind of, I don't want to say it's on the fringes, but it's certainly, I would say
police,
it's not
overreach, secrecy of the Australian government.
Exactly. And I would say it's not really a mainstream story. And so it's something that's, yeah, not everyone is talking about, not everyone has a clear sort of take on. And so,
well, there the difficulty is that you have to explain the story in the satire, which is really hard.
That's a really good point. Ideal sketch is something where everyone already knows what you're talking
about.
Yeah,
there's no background.
There's
to explain.
No background. And
I mentioned John Stewart earlier, and that was one of the revolutionary things about what he did to The Daily Show, I think, which is within the pre-John Stewart Daily Show with Craig Kilborn was gags and punchlines mostly about the Kardashians or whoever was the equivalent in the late 90s. And then Jon Stewart started actually describing the news and explaining the news. And through the course of explaining what you needed to know about the news, he would also insert jokes about it and then bring you to a satisfying payoff.
Exactly. And he had the time to do that.
And the 25 writers.
Yes, that's it. Because I've got
two. You have 22 writers?
That's right, 22. So I've got, So I write with a guy named Evan Williams. We've been running together for years. So it's the two of us. And yeah, we've got 2 to 3 minutes once a fortnight. So we get one swing, you know, once a fortnight. We've got to choose one topic once a fortnight. And yeah, ideally, the less time that we can spend explaining what the story is means, you know, the more time for the actual jokes. So something like Witness K, something that we did do a sketch about, but it was difficult trying to convey. Also, it's also difficult to...
Was the sketch any good?
Well, I mean, I don't... Maybe not, but that's part of it. That's what, like I said, maybe the sketch wasn't particularly fantastic, but I know one of the challenges for us making it was that not all the information is out there in both senses. Both people aren't aware of it, then it's not a mainstream story, and also there's a lot of secrecy around the story itself.
Yeah, right.
So some of the details are not clear. You know, the fact that we've been calling them Witness K.
Yeah.
you know, they're not lighting up Instagram, this person.
Right? No, that's right.
Well, they may be. We're just not aware.
We don't know who they are.
We just don't know who they are. So that's sort of something where it's like, now that to me, that felt like something that was worth talking about. But how quickly can you convey that? And then once you've, all right, does everyone understand the story? Okay, we spent 30 seconds explaining it. All right, now here's something funny about it.
I mean, that's right. Get ready to giggle. But I reckon there's a third category of sketch, isn't there? There's not just the one that everybody knows about or the one that people don't know about. There's doing the story that people know about in a way that they would never predict that you were going to do it.
Yes, sure.
Which is, because like, There's nothing lazier or more annoying than knowing exactly where the gag or the take is going to go,
yes,
and then pandering to the audience all the way,
yes,
and delivering them exactly what they wanted.
Yes. Yeah, I'm trying to think of specific examples. I know there have been things that have come up where there's been a quite an obvious way that you could send something up, and people might even tweet it at me. They might even, that's the thing. What if I see someone,
by the time people are suggesting your satirical sketches to you on Twitter,
that's it. I mean, that's sort of, you know, that's one of the things. Like, if I see that someone's tweeted that idea, I can't in good conscience go and make that thing. So I don't want to be doing something that I know has already been thought up by someone else. You know, like, an example, this is a weird example, but so there's a guy named Barnaby Joyce who is now the Deputy Prime Minister of Australia. He had previously been in this position, but had been sort of brought down through a series of scandals. Anyway, he's back in the role now. And I've for years now been doing a character sort of loosely inspired by him called, because part of his scandal was that he had impregnated his staffer. He was married, he then impregnated his staffer, and
I love the use of the term impregnated here.
He fucked
his staffer and got her pregnant. We're not on the ABC.
It sounds
like they went to an IVF clinic and he paid good money for a scientist.
There was a syringe involved.
Yeah, that's right.
And so they had child, and obviously it ended his marriage and what have you, and damaged his political career. So I've been doing a character based on Barnaby Joyce for several years now called Barabbas Loins. Now, I can say with great confidence that it's highly unlikely that anyone else on Twitter came up with the name Barabbas Loins. So when I do Barabbas Loins, that's my thing. That's
yours.
My version of that.
Mm-hmm. How does Barabbas speak?
Barabbas basically speaks like someone who is not particularly competent or confident on camera, but he's sort of, it usually starts with "G'day, my name's Barabbas Loins, member for Offalseed and minister for Troy Cassar Daly," is a country and western singer. So the joke is he's always minister for some sort of country related, you know, thing.
Regional minister and rural.
Exactly. Minister for Bushman's Hankies.
Yeah.
Minister for reruns of McLeod's Daughters. You know, that kind of thing. So I can confidently say no one else is going to.
No, that's right.
Do that.
And so are you having to cobble together something about this right now?
Yes, that's it. So now that he's back, I've got to do something on that. And it's been actually exciting because, like, on Twitter, people, you know, loads, I've had so many tweets of people saying, "Oh, this is terrible news about Barnaby Joyce, but great to see Barabbas Loins is coming back." You know, so from a kind of career standpoint, it's quite good for me, even though a lot of people would not be enthusiastic.
Look,
about this.
I remember looking at the polls for John Howard as we were going into the 2007 election.
Right.
And I was like, my career is over. You know, this has been my bread and butter since 2002.
Yeah. It's funny, 2007. Like, I was living in France. In 2007.
Well, la-dee-da, from crow's nest to France.
I've done it all. And I had no idea of the momentum that was building behind Kevin Rudd at that time. I remember just being in my own world and thinking, oh, Howard's been Prime Minister for almost, you know, as long as
150 years.
Yeah, as long as I've been sort of switched on.
He'll be emperor for another 150 more.
Who's Kevin Rudd? He'll never win. And I remember I went to Paris to vote, and I went to the, you know, sorry, it sounds so pretentious, but it's what happened. I was on a school, you know, I was on a uni exchange thing, and I went to vote, and there were people in Paris wearing Kevin 07 shirts.
Wow.
And I was like, am I missing something? And yes, I was.
Wow. Le Kevin 07.
Yeah,
it doesn't even rhyme.
No, it doesn't even work in French.
And they did it.
So, and it was so fascinating. Just so that began a lot. Yeah, so since then I've tried to be slightly more clued in.
Yeah, that I think that would help if you can. You're going to see at least a change of administration at a minimum. You would expect to be something that a satirist would keep their eye on.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I just started doing Kevin Rudd instead of John Howard.
Right,
and that eventually just fell apart.
Oh, dear.
He's just not as funny.
Do you still pull out the Howard from time to time just for?
No, because I think Howard is too. Occasionally. It's meant occasionally people just insist, and so it's just easier just to do it. And then, and the way that I get around doing an impression without doing an impression is to articulate a particular mannerism of speech that the person does and then incorporate it into my refusal to do the impression.
Great.
So one for Howard, what I would always tell people who were working on their John Howards to do is that he would have a, what I would call like a sort of a preemptive negation of whatever it was that he was saying. So he might say, far be it from me to do some kind of an impression. No, I will not. And so that kind of stammering series of no's becomes then the impression as you're refusing to do the impression.
That's great. That reminds me of Dana Carvey, because he was obviously known for his George Bush Senior impression, and one of his phrases was "Not gonna do it." And so if people so if people ask him to do the impression, he says no. I think he'll say something like, you may want me to do the impression, but not gonna do it."
Who did Clinton on?
You did have Phil Hartman did it. Daryl Hammond.
Daryl Hammond, who I interviewed a bunch of times on HuffPost Live. He's another great SNL person.
Yeah, yeah.
Who was fascinating because he is completely apolitical. Talk about you not being interested in the news. He not only wasn't interested in the news, didn't know anything about the news, and was incapable of being sufficiently interested for long enough to even understand what he was saying. So all of those classic sketches about where he was playing Clinton – going up against Al Gore, against Bob Dole, and then during like the early years of, I guess it would have been the late 90s, he didn't even know what the jokes were about. I mean, with the exception of the broad knowledge that Clinton was embroiled in some kind of sex scandal, he only knew
Trump for the stakes. That was his whole thing. But that's interesting. Yeah, wow, okay.
Isn't that amazing? So for him, it's purely performative. It's just about noticing the mannerisms.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, sure. But again, and I envy these people, because I have this, simultaneously I feel like I seriously think people need to be engaged in politics. They need to be switched on. They need to be reading. They need to be know what's happening. And if you can also avoid knowing what's going on, then I wish that's the best possible thing.
Or just focus on the big stuff. Like, have you heard the Oliver Berkman episode of this show? It's one of the early episodes. You should listen to it, because it touches on something here that you would like. Oliver is a writer for The Guardian who lives in New York, who has his own column in The Guardian globally, and it's about happiness and psychology. And his thesis is basically, at the moment, we're all paying way too much attention to the news, and we're using it as a proxy for actual life. So we're spending, it sort of sounds a little bit like what Jordan Peterson was saying in a way, which is we're not spending enough time actually enmeshed in our communities and our lives and our cats. And we're spending way too much time exercising ourselves about things that actually don't really matter. And we're using that as a way of feeling almost not just good about ourselves, but better than other people who know less about things that are going on abroad. Yes, as if the fact that my next door neighbor is tending to her garden instead of fretting about what's happening with the coronavirus in India makes her a worse person. Right. But actually, my fretting about the coronavirus in India isn't affecting anything.
Sure.
So I'd be better off looking after a plant and actually doing some good.
Yes, that's interesting. I had to deliver some bad news to someone today about someone who'd died. And it was so strange. Like, within seconds of me telling them the news that this person that we both knew had died, they went, yeah. Well, interesting to see Barnaby back in there. It was like almost just didn't know how to talk about it.
Were they close with this person?
Not hugely close, but knew them pretty well. And it was just
it's funny, isn't it? We're so unprepared.
Yeah. It was just
so bizarre. I don't know how I would.
What was there to say?
I mean, when I was in high school, our deputy principal died. And I found out, because I was like school wanker prefect or something. I don't remember what capacity, school, student union or something. And I had to call all my peers and tell them. So it was the only time in my life where I've had a succession of psychological experiments by hearing people's reaction to some powerful news. He was a beloved figure, a fantastic guy, the confidant of all of us as a school community, and we would have been in probably year 12, so I think we were old enough to be grown-ups. Mm-hmm. And it was so fascinating to hear some people burst out laughing and said, "What?"
Wow.
Some people were silent for 15 seconds. A few cried. Most didn't. Some changed the subject. Huh. Others asked lots of personal questions about how it happened.
Yes, yes.
It's really interesting. That's... Like none of us has a... It's one of those areas where you don't have the template to pull out of your jacket pocket.
That's so interesting. I think something that I think about when sometimes, like the other day, I had to get an Uber because the trains were cancelled because clearly something had happened. Someone had, you know, jumped in front of a train or something. I think they had even announced it. I mean, I don't think they're supposed to, but I think they'd even announced someone's been hit by a train. So I called an Uber and they were asking something like, oh, why are you getting an Uber? And I was like, oh, well, the trains aren't running because someone, sounds like someone got hit by a train. And they're like, oh, did they die? I was like,
I don't know.
But they don't know. And also just like, don't ask. Like, even if they didn't, I mean, assume they probably, if you get hit by a train.
And were they torn completely apart? Yeah, were they recognizable?
I was weirdly annoyed by it. Yeah. And there's also that thing where, when you get that piece of news that the trains have been cancelled, you've got to juggle those two competing feelings, which is, oh, Jesus Christ, I'm already running late, and now what am I going to do? And then, like, someone right now has had the worst possible thing happen to them, and there's going to be rippling effects on their friends and family. And it's so weird, this moment where you're preoccupied, and I always try and kind of just take a step back and go, there's bigger things at play here.
Yeah.
You're going to be late and that's fine.
Yeah. No, I remember my mum saying that when we were living in London, she was on at a tube station and they said that the underground's delayed because of a body on the tracks. And there was a woman standing next to her who went, oh, inconsiderate, and looked at her watch.
Yeah, sure.
And mum, like, that affected her so much. Like, yeah. She came home and told us about it. Like, imagine being that much of a bitch.
That's it. I remember thinking, it's something. I was in London in 2005 when the tube bombings occurred, and there was the bus as well. Mm. Was it July 7th?
Yep, 7/7.
And I was catching the tube that morning. I went down into whichever station I was at, and I went to buy a ticket. And as I was buying the ticket, the system, suddenly the woman behind the counter said, "Oh, the system says I can't sort of like shut down. I can't sell your ticket. You're going to have to walk." I was like, what? It's like, she's like, I don't know. Something's happened. You're going to have to walk. I was like, oh, okay. And so I walked to where I needed to get to. And then I was visiting family outside of London. And it was not until hours later that I found out what had actually happened. Anyway, I came back to London at the end of the day. And obviously for that period, for the whole day, there'd been no trains or buses. And just at the very end of the day, they started up some services again. And I just remember people pushing and shoving to get onto the onto the bus. And I was just like, surely this is the time to all just kind of look out for each other. Let's take our time. Let's not rush.
For a start, if you don't make it onto the bus, bus might blow
that's
up
it.
Anyway. So
maybe that's
calm
this
down.
Is your lucky day. So, yeah, human nature. I mean, that's it, obviously, sometimes. Like, Come From Away is a musical that's currently showing in Sydney. Have you seen this by any chance?
I've interviewed the creators and the writers of it, and I never managed to get around to seeing it I was living in New York, and I was in Queensland for the opening night a couple of weeks ago, so I couldn't make it that either.
Oh, okay.
So all of that is a roundabout way of apologising to anyone who might be involved in Come From Away who's listening to this. I haven't willfully not seen it. I want to.
Well, anyway, long story short, about what happened after 9/11, all the planes that had to ground all the other planes that were in the air in case any of the others had been hijacked. And this, you know, the small town in Newfoundland took in thousands of people. And it was just this amazing story of humans coming together and looking out for each other. And so I guess what I'm saying is, at least there's that.
There's the human coming together, but then maybe there's not that much of it. Like, I thought that the pandemic would bring us all together.
I thought
as well.
So too. Yes.
It didn't. I mean, if anything, it's exacerbated divisions, certainly in the countries where it's been the most intense, like the United States.
Maybe
and the
UK. We weren't in a good position to have a pandemic at that.
Well, I mean, looping this back to social media where we started, I wonder whether this inability to raise our eyes off the minutiae of life and be appreciative and grateful for the big picture is contaminated by social media where, you know, like, I said in my Melbourne Comedy Festival show, like, it's amazing to me that when I was in my teens, you would make a plan to meet someone at the movies in the city.
Yes.
And if they were 10 minutes late, You just stood there. And it's amazing to me that that's amazing to me, because that wouldn't have seemed that odd.
I know. I waited for a friend, I think, close to an hour. I mean, and
there's nothing you can do. Nothing. You can go to a payphone, but who are you going to call? Exactly. They don't have a phone.
Same thing. A friend of mine waited an hour for me because I had something happened to me on my way to meet up with them. Yes, extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary.
And not just the inability to contact them. Your life was punctuated by the need to do nothing.
Oh yes, of course.
So you're standing there for seven, even if it's 7 minutes, waiting for your friend outside the movie cinema.
Oh yes,
those are 7 minutes in which you are required to do nothing but look at the people going past, and gaze at the clouds, think your own thoughts.
I think I had to spend the way my mind worked was I was performing that entire time, which was I am performing someone who is fine. I'm fine. They'll be here any minute.
Right,
it's okay.
Sure.
I'm not. They haven't forgotten about me.
I'm not being jilted.
That's it. Everything.
Please, mummy, don't leave me alone. Don't abandon me.
That's it. So that's, I'm doing a whole performance the whole time. So I think that's where all my mental energy went, is portraying a man who is comfortable with aging.
Are you still doing that performance, Mark?
I think I'm performing all the time. I think that's what's so. I think I'm fascinated by the performances that we do for each other every single day. Whether it's as you're passing someone in a narrow corridor and you do that weird half smile to the, that's a performance, and that took energy and you thought about it.
But isn't a part of the appeal? One thing that we find appealing about charismatic people is that they don't seem to be performing.
Sure. Yes.
Right. Like the less performance, the less artifice there seems to be, the more charming we think the person is.
Yeah.
There's nothing, because a person who seems to be putting on the charm is sleazy.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's true.
Yeah. I'm just noting
that. I'm giving you some advice, Mark.
Yeah, exactly.
I think you're coming on a little strong.
Take the hint. You're a sleaze bag, son. No, I sometimes also wonder whether or not our creativity got fostered in those moments of nothingness.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Then the moments of nothingness are now deprived of us by social media, because you have a supercomputer that you can pull out of your pocket and see what other people are saying about Peter Credlin and her award.
That's it, yeah.
Instead of having to come up with a relationship to your own existence.
Yeah, I think I'm generally an optimist, so I will I'll tell myself, well, I'm absorbing information and I'm taking in stuff that may one day lead to some sort of creative, a lightning bolt moment. I'm not having it right now.
You're fooling yourself, son. This is the trick of social media. It convinces you that what you're doing is worthy.
Yeah, but I mean, podcasts is like this. That's something that I actually feel. I feel great about podcasts. I love that. You know, that is there for me in those dull moments, that I feel like I am injecting some sort of entertainment or information.
Well, it's also a place where you have enough time that you can talk about things that, like, especially on this show, where we intentionally talk about, like you were just saying earlier, like, what were you saying, inseminating or something, instead of just
impregnating.
Fucking. Yeah, impregnating. But, like, the idea that you, because to be contrarian on Twitter is going to cause all kinds of problems, because really, if you're saying anything interesting, then you can't do it justice in the space that Twitter has for it. Whereas when you're talking for an hour and a half to somebody, you can say the thing, you can articulate it, you can throw around some ideas, you can bat them about. It's still possible to be cancelled from it, but you can only be cancelled if people are willfully trying to misrepresent your good intentions.
Yes,
right.
Yes,
whereas on Twitter, it's very easy to be misunderstood.
Yes, totally.
You just say "fuck Peter Credlin," which is not an appropriate thing to say, nor something I believe.
That just reminded me of something that I used to do on Twitter, which I don't do anymore because I gain nothing from it. But sometimes there'll be a news story that'll go around that will just raise. There'll be a flag will go up where you just go, that sounds like bullshit to me, and I'll look into it further, I'll come to a conclusion that this story is not really all that it seems. But if you then come in and say, hey guys, I know we've all been having fun with this story, but if you actually read a little bit further, you might see actually it's a completely innocent misunderstanding. And so I've done that in the past, where I was going, hey everyone, this is actually what actually happened here with blah blah blah. No one wants to know.
No, no. Of course not. Yeah, let us play, nerd bucket. Yeah.
Actually, I just dug into the data.
Yeah, actually, the person who appeared to have a passport with the name Fuck That Bitch, P-H-U-C-D-A-T-B-I-C-H, it's actually a lie. They actually made it up. I mean, that was a specific example.
Really?
Yeah. Was this like, surely, do you remember, there was a story where there was like, oh, I think it was like a Vietnamese man, his passport, his name is Fuck That Bitch, P-H-U-C-D-A-T-B-I-C-H. And I was just like, I think we would have heard about this guy before now. I think surely everyone, if there was
that was your thinking?
Well, I was thinking in Australia, surely.
Carl Stefanovic would have been all over it, surely. It would have been across the morning shows.
This person was now, I think, 25 or something. I think they'd, you know, they'd grown up in Australia. Surely it would have gone around every school that there was a kid named Fuck That Bitch. There was, and I was like, this does not add up. And then as things came out, eventually it was revealed, yes, they made it up. And there's no prizes for being right.
No, there are no prizes for being right. Not on Twitter. Of course not. Not on Twitter.
No.
So ultimately, what would you like to do beyond this current gig? Sitcom?
Well, I would, because it is still the dream. I mean, I'd love to do.
Were your sitcom fantasy hero?
Weirdly, the Golden Girls was actually one of my main ones.
Well, that's true. Actually, when we were kids, the most popular shows in Australia were probably the Golden Girls, Family Ties, Roseanne,
Cosby Show.
Was the Cosby Show still on?
When I was
maybe
kid. Into the early 90s.
Yep.
Yeah.
You were watching it when you were three. That makes sense. And
Murphy Brown.
Yeah. Candace Bergen.
Yeah.
And there was another one that I was just thinking of. Roseanne, I said.
I mean, I could list more. There was Grace Under Fire. There was Caroline in the City. There was Veronica's Closet.
Yeah. Oh, no. I remember what I was thinking of. This always amazes me when I tell Americans. And, in fact, I told Fran Drescher when she was on HuffPost Live that The Nanny was the number one show in Australia. The number one show of all shows in Australia at the time that it was on. And she was like, why? And I was like, I don't know. Like, what? When you think about it, what does this have to do with she's from Flushing in Queens.
That's so true.
She's such an archetypal character from that particular part of the world.
This is why I always get a little – it's funny, like something that comes up in terms of Australian funding bodies for like screen content, something that's always pushed is this idea of Australian content, Australian stories. And then at the same time, there's questions about – well, but can this play internationally? You know,
right.
So we want to make these sort of Australian stories, but in terms of like anything beyond that, just like, well, because that's the other thing that I think probably they're thinking about more now is, could this be something that plays on?
Yeah, can we make our money back from international sales?
And I always go, Alan Partridge is so specific, and yet, you know, and I've never been to Norwich, but I don't need to know who Sue Cook is for me to understand, oh, she's clearly a media personality, that Alan has some sort of semi-frustrated, you know, relationship with. The idea that, yes, The Nanny can be a big hit here, why not? And so that's why the success of Bluey is thrilling, because it's like, we can just make something that, it's Australian voices and, you know, but people can relate to the general sort of family gist of it.
There was a great line by, there's a wonderful writing coach / stand-up comedy coach, like kind of a god of New York stand-up, who runs classes in Manhattan, called Steve Rosenfield, who founded the American Comedy Institute, who became something of a mentor of mine when I moved there, because he was so good at honing my generalized funny ideas into jokes that would actually get laughs at clubs when I was doing stand-up when I first went there. And he had the best piece of advice about writing, which is the specific is universal. He was like, don't try to make things appeal to everybody, because then they become generic and they feel pat. They seem like cliches. Everybody's done that before. But like, if you talk about something that's extremely specific to you, then in its authenticity, it'll resonate with everybody, because they won't have exactly the same situation, but they'll have something close enough that smells, because it smells so real.
Yes.
Like Woody Allen, is like so specific, and yet he appeals to so many people because he's sui generis. That's like, he's exactly what he is.
But Larry David, like, it feels like it's extremely.
Even Seinfeld, the whole show. I mean, you could make the same argument about the nanny, right? Like, Seinfeld is a very particular milieu.
And I remember Fran Drescher appearing on Conan years ago, and she told this anecdote. I thought it was such an interesting snapshot of fame at that level, where she was talking about how, I think she'd met a guy, she'd got on with him, and then I think went back to his place or what have you, and then I think, you know, he didn't impregnate her, but they had sex, and then
that man was Barnaby Dix.
And then he rolled over and he said, "Man, can't believe I just fucked the nanny." And just like, can you imagine hearing that? Just like, but that's how you exist in someone's brain.
Yeah. That's weird, isn't it? Fame would be weird. Do you experience it?
I don't know. I'm sort of a very low level. I mean, like, usually just mistaken for someone else. So, but like, I mean, I do. Yeah, I remember like some, at a cafe, and someone came up to me and said, "Sorry, I'm so sorry. Are you Bondi Vet?" and I went, "Oh, no, I'm not Bondi Vet." She's like, "Oh, I'm sorry. Have a good day." And she's walking off, and I'm like, "Well, but I am semi-famous in my own right. Come back.
I'm the other tall blonde on television."
Occasionally I'll get stopped, and I had one thing recently where I had my two boys with me, and it was a bad day. It was a really bad day where something had gone wrong at a play center. One of them was crying, and everything was just very, very difficult. And then the youngest one, the 2-year-old, he wet his pants, and so, okay, I gotta go find a parent's room, sort that out. And then we go and get some dinner. It was just me with the two boys. And then the youngest wet his pants again, like in the middle of food court, and like actually pissed on the floor.
Have you heard of nappies?
No, because he actually has been trained. So he's beyond that phase, and then just decided to give us a recap. Oh. And so then I'm wiping up, you know, grabbing all the napkins from the, you know, dinner and wiping up the piss, and I'm carrying these piss-soaked napkins to the bin, and some guy comes up to me and goes, "Mr. Humphreys, a big fan?" And I was like, "My youngest has just pissed his pants twice in the last half hour. Thank you, I needed this."
Thank you. Thank you very much. You've made my day a little better. Yeah, that's funny. I mean, that's part of being on telly as well. I mean, the radio is good. Radio is blessed because people who know you, but they can't tell that you're you just by you walking past down the street.
Sure.
Although one funny thing is there were a few occasions where I would just be talking in public, and this has only happened really after being on Joe Rogan's podcast, which I was on 6 times and has, you know, 100 million listeners or something.
Sure.
And so once I was with my parents, they had come over to Europe for a holiday, and I'd come over from New York to visit them. This wasn't long ago, and we went to Auschwitz.
Oh gosh! Because
Dad's mum was a Holocaust survivor, and I mean, she wasn't in the death camps, but all her family were. She managed to come to Australia and escape during the war. But so we're at Auschwitz, and we just exit, and I hear, "Excuse me, Josh, are you Josh Sepps? Man, I heard you on Joe. I can just tell by your accent." And I was like,
"Wow,
I've just been through the most traumatized." Yeah, like I've just been looking at piles of shoes.
Oh my gosh. Sucked out of that reality.
Yeah, but it was nice.
Yeah. Oh,
it was
that's
flattering.
I mean,
it was very kind. People being generous.
Now that's the interesting thing, because inevitably we have come across people in day-to-day life who hate us. You know, people have heard us, seen us, do not like it. But thank heavens, in reality,
they don't say anything. Unless they're on Twitter.
But if they're on Twitter, they
make themselves well and truly known.
That's it.
Yeah.
And that's
So sitcoms, so the nanny and things like that. But so you weren't drawn to, like, satirical, I guess, were there satirical things?
No, I wasn't. I mean, I don't think I was. No, I mean, I certainly saw Clark and watched Clark and Dawe, you know, when I was a kid, but I never thought I would end up, you know, down that path. No, I just liked the idea of, you know,
I mean, I guess there was like South Park, which was satire. Scripted satire.
And something that at that age I probably wasn't as conscious of as being satirical. But now, I mean, I haven't watched South Park in a couple of years, but any time I watch South Park now, I always go, God, that is the most base sort of childish approach to making that really sharp point. Well played.
Like, yeah, absolutely.
I'm always impressed. I'm always going to...
I mean, their movie, have you seen the movie? South Park
Bigger,
movie?
Longer, Uncut. Yeah.
Which, by the way, you know, it was originally written as South Park All Hell Breaks Loose. And the studio said, you can't say hell. That's going to offend people. So they brought it back as Bigger, Longer, and Uncut. And the studio didn't get the gag.
Amazing. I always love those stories about how people get around these restrictions. Yeah. But I haven't seen it in years. But
I mean, it's worth a rewatch. Not that I've seen it in about 5 years, but when I did watch it a second time, like, it is so beautifully meta. Because the plot, if you'll recall, is about... satirists who make a cartoon that's so offensive that the US goes to war with Canada to avenge the offense caused by the cartoon movie, which of course is a proxy for this movie in itself and a predictor of the inevitable outrage which it will cause.
Right.
It's
fantastic. And so, you know, I'm always impressed by that. But, you know, it was not something that appealed to me. But, ideally, you know, the logical thing would be I'd love to make, you know, Australia's version of The Thick of It or Veep, but we have had, you know, we've had The Hollow Man and there's Utopia, which sort of is kind of a version. It's sort of in that space. So I don't know if the time is right for the sort of show that I would.
Well, you just have to do it right. I mean, Veep takes the conceit and then elevates it to that whole new kind of, I don't know, Upright Citizens Brigade inspired level of sort of 30 Rock, Tina Fey, rapid fire, absurdist humor. I'd love to see some of that here. Do you worry about getting cancelled?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's a funny thing because I know in my heart of hearts what I'm trying to say with a sketch and what my intention is. But I am absolutely conscious of the ability to get it wrong, to actually have blind spots, get it wrong, be people's own interpretations of things that maybe you intended something one way, but it comes across another way, and then see people who deliberately, willfully misrepresent and are waiting for you to screw up, and because they would love to take you down. But I mean, I'll give you a concrete example a few weeks ago of one where we just a short little thing that we agonized over. And so what it was there was a campaign that the government had paid for, which was to teach young people about consent. And the way that it was done was with this...
The
milkshake ad, yes. So
why don't I play a bit of the milkshake ad?
Put in a bit of the milkshake ad.
To cross into the action zone, both people must agree.
Do you want to try my milkshake?
Yes, I do.
Is it better than yours?
You know, I think I prefer mine.
But what happens when one person takes action without an agreement?
You do, huh? Well, drink it. Drink it all.
What are you doing?
Drink it all.
This is what we call moving the line.
So that was the milkshake ad.
Yeah, so it was
a little bit confusing.
Very confusing. Which seems to be inspired by a British comedy called Look Around You from about 20 years ago that Peter Serafinovich had co-created, which is well worth looking up. For some reason, that seemed to be a reference point for them in this. And then there's the whole milkshake subplot, whatever. Anyway, so I've occasionally on 7:30 done a character who is like a sort of a film director who works with the government. It's a character named Tony Chevelle. And he, you know, whenever, you know, sometimes it might've been that he was Scott Morrison's social media video producer, and in this case he was the man who directed these milkshake campaigns. And we had this one section which was that well, you think this idea was bad. You should have seen some of the other ideas that had been floated. And so firstly, the conceit is already that what you're about to see is a worse idea. Now, that's inherently a problematic potentially already, because you're now actually going to make something that might be offensive or bad, but you're knowingly doing it, and you're knowingly satirizing the pretend thing that you've created. So what the idea was that there was a character. This is context for American audiences. In the 1980s, there was a comedy character on a show called The Comedy Company called Con the Fruiterer. He was a Greek fruiterer, you know, grocery, worked in the grocery, and had a series of catchphrases, and he was an iconic character. And so our idea was that there was going to part of the consent campaign was that a character they'd created called Consent the Fruiterer. So we have this idea of Consent the Fruiterer. We're going to do this sort of homage parody of Con the Fruiterer wrapped in this, you know, consent idea. And then the question became, right, who can play Consent the Fruiterer? Because part of the problem with Con the Fruiterer was that it was a white man named Mark Mitchell playing a Greek character. Now, there are two trains of thought on this. There are those who say that he was embraced by the Greek community and was a beloved character. And yes, it was a white man, but we loved him anyway. And he was good for the community. And he was a positive, you know, character. And then there are those who say it should never have been a white man playing that character. It's offensive to play, you know, you know what the arguments are. Mm. So there's these two trains of thought. Okay. So keeping that in mind, can we now add another layer? Can Consent the Fruiterer, if I'm parodying this white man who played a Greek man, can I play
a man
can I as a white man play a white man playing a Greek character? So we weren't sure about that. And there is a comedian that Evan and I love, I think a Greek Australian named Alexi Toliopoulos, and we reached out to him and said, oh, is any chance you'd be interested in doing this? He was not able to do it, but Dan Illich was able to do it. Now, Dan is not the right,
he's ethnic, not the right sort
not
of
the
ethnic.
Right ethnicity,
yeah.
Even though his grandfather was an Italian grocer. So there's all this stuff that we're now agonizing over is can Dan Illich, with his Italian grocer grandfather.
I mean, he looks like he could have been a Greek
right,
grocer,
sure.
Dan.
You know, he matches the image. We got ourselves tangled up in knots about this. Ultimately, we did it with Dan. Dan was great. And the response was fantastic. And so it was fine. But the reality is that to get to that point of being fine, we spent a good hour or two discussing, can we do this?
And I guess the question then for the broader culture becomes, in moments like that, was something gained?
By agonizing about it?
By agonizing it and ending up casting Dan instead of you doing it.
Well, I think something was gained in the sense that I think Dan's terrific, so I'm very happy to have Dan.
No, but you didn't cast him because he's terrific.
Oh, well, I think it's a combination of you wanted someone who could nail it and also ideally could match that character so that you would be able to put out that potential fire. So
that's right. But what I mean is the existence of those fires doing something good? Because I'm perfectly happy for there to be fires when they're in the service of justice.
Yeah. Yes. So I guess my...
is Dan more deserving of, is the point that the Dans of the world, I think the point is that people of color have been so long overlooked.
Yes.
And there have been these lazy casting decisions where you would just get a white heartthrob in Hollywood to play an Asian and you would like tape down their eyes and they'd go, oh, me Chinese. And you'd think that was okay. Uh-huh. So you want to rectify that and make sure that doesn't happen again and make sure that if there are brilliant Asian actors, they actually get a look in for those parts. Is Dan one of those? Not really. Like, I love Dan. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he did a great job. He's not even a member of the community who you're satirizing here. He's not a member of the Greek community. He just sort of looks a bit like it. So then the question mark becomes like, what's the point of this whole dance?
Well, I mean, I think the broad answer I would give is that it's certainly, I think it's good to be aware of these things. I think it's important to be consciously trying to make sure that you're not repeating the mistakes of the past and just kind of perpetuating, you know, problems that have already existed. I think from a selfish standpoint, no, it was not useful to me because it wasted writing time and time that could have been spent on making the sketch better was spent agonizing over a backlash that, you know, didn't happen. Yeah, from a selfish standpoint, no, it was not useful at all. From a broader conversational standpoint,
I'm just thinking to myself, thinking out loud now, maybe there's a secondary objective in addition to making sure that people of color aren't excluded from parts, which is that you want everything that's coming out to sort of look more and more like the country. You know, it's a bit like you're saying about Film Australia. You want to tell uniquely Australian stories. So if part of the Australian story is the migrant story from Greece, then you want someone who at least looks passably Greek to be in that. Otherwise, everything looks like it's a caricature.
Yes,
which I suppose makes sense. But we are getting to a point at which, as you say, I think there's a lot of man hours and woman hours being put into preemptively avoiding those fires.
Yeah, and I think, and it comes also part of it as well is just I guess I would argue for a general kind of good faith based discourse, which is extremely naive, but just like I sort of hope that people would kind of, I'd like to see a little bit more benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, well, I mean, have you seen that Lin-Manuel Miranda has just put out an apology for In the Heights?
Right.
Lin-Manuel Miranda, who wrote Hamilton before he wrote Hamilton, had this other hit, brilliant musical called In the Heights, which has just come out in the movie theaters, and he has had to do one of these sort of groveling apologies about how I'm going to listen and learn, and now is, you know, my time to learn from my mistakes, because he, as a Latino guy who has written nothing but Latino and Black stories of American culture and history, apparently didn't cast enough Black Latinos in The Heights.
Right.
So they weren't dark-skinned enough. There was a lack of representation because they were more slightly pale-skinned kind of Cubano Latinos in the cast. So, like,
yeah, I mean,
I think if Lin-Manuel Miranda isn't good enough for you, the man who turned the Founding Fathers black and has just released a brilliant blockbuster about, you know, centering Latino voices.
Yes, it's funny as well, like, I don't...
He has to apologize?
Yeah, this is sort of related. I don't know if it... Because I'm not quite sure how the criticism started coming up. But one thing I'm very interested in is this... there have been times where... I can think of three times where I've seen someone say something on Twitter where I can very quickly realize they don't actually understand what they've said and that what they've just put out there is going to be offensive to some people. And on those occasions, I've gone and fortunately there were people who were following me and I've gone and DM'd those people.
Oh, that's generous.
And just gone, just so you know, I know that you probably didn't mean this, but that image that you've just posted or that joke you just made or what have you, actually, there's actually this backstory to it. And it's been so interesting every single time that those people have come back and said, oh my God, thank you so much for making me aware of this. I've deleted Twitter. Now, obviously, within the manual, we can't delete a film. But this, I can't remember the name of the lady who has coined the term calling in as opposed to calling out.
Oh, that's good.
I'm a big fan of, if you see something where you suspect that the person probably had the best intention, but maybe not the best execution. If there's any way
if they're standing in front of the bus, just push them out of the way before the bus hits them.
If there's any way that you can help them out, rather, because I think it's such an interesting choice when someone decides to hit that quote tweet button and just goes, oh, I could go and try and help this person who I can clearly see has just accidentally stepped on a landmine. Instead, I've decided to do my little performance. Hey, everybody.
Yeah.
You know, and also this is the thing I don't understand. If we agree that the thing is offensive, why is it so important and that people should not see the offensive thing?
Why do you want to blow it up?
Broadcasting it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I kind of. Yeah.
But that's not the point. We all know that's not the point.
Exactly.
The point is to grandstand.
Exactly.
And to create, to have a witch hunt.
Yes.
And to throw the virgin into the rim of the volcano to appease the gods.
That's it. So anyway, that's my sort of Twitter 101. If you see someone and you get the sense from their track record that they're probably a decent person who've just walked, you know, walked through the wrong door.
Yeah, and sometimes they're a person who just hasn't thought about it, but they, because, you know, Twitter is also fast. Yes. Stuff just pours out of your fingers pretty quickly. Yeah. And did you see the case of the British broadcaster who's one of these old, very funny, like Frankie so-and-so, who's been around forever and he still had a radio show on, I think, LBC in the UK. And when Harry and Meghan had their first child, he has a long history of doing these funny jokes of like, you know, in the 1950s, like chimps dressed up in royal outfits and things like that.
An
old black and white photo of a couple of chimps, one in a tuxedo and the other one in a bridal gown or something, and a little chimp baby or something.
Yes.
It was like he had like breaking, you know, first images of royal family exiting hospital. And it didn't occur to him that Meghan is a woman of color and there are these historical things. For him, it's funny because it's a chimp in a costume. And he lost his show.
Of course.
Yeah, he lost his show. And, you know, it wasn't. He even deleted it the moment someone raised that, the moment someone said, you know, there's that whole thing, that whole history here. And he was like, oh, shit. And, you know, there's a history of him tweeting monkeys in preposterous outfits throughout his career where it has nothing to do with people of color. But he did it too fast.
Yes. And sure. Yeah, caught. Totally. And it's funny because sometimes there'll be a thing where people, you'll see like, oh, I noticed blah, 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 deleted this. Why did you delete this? It's just like, if they've deleted it, just they've clearly realized they've screwed up. Just
also because they knew you were going to come for them. you can't on the one hand say, why did you delete it? And also, why don't you delete it, you monster?
So if you're someone who has a track record, you know, if you're someone who is just clearly, you know, if you're someone who's just, you know, I don't want to start naming names, but just if you're someone who's clearly a troll or what have you and is always, you know, putting out horrible stuff, go after that person. But if it's someone who just clearly is just gone through the wrong door, if you can, try and for their own mental health, because that's the thing. Like, I'm a big believer people should read John Ronson's So You've Been Publicly Shamed, just like the damage that can be done by these pylons on people who, yes, they fucked up, but like, if we can find ways to not make a global thing out of them, there's no winner.
The fact that I even know the name Justine Sacco
is horrendous. Sure. Yes,
and
exactly.
If you don't know her, good that you don't.
That's it.
But read John Ronson's book because it's absolutely fabulous.
I think before you get your Twitter account, they just go, can you just have a look at this? If you can just read this, or you can do the audio book and hear him say, this book was written by me, John Ronson. And then you can have a Twitter account and away we go.
He's a public treasure, as are you, Mark Humphreys. You. Your book going to be
On Politics and Stuff. And it is available everywhere. And
available everywhere very soon, in time for what may or may not be a federal election in Australia. We don't know when it's coming.
It's a short read, so if you're not a big fan of reading,
if you hate the book, then you'll love its brevity.
Exactly, it'll be over in hours. Yeah, so Evan Williams and I have written, we've packed it with jokes about Australian politics, and we hope you enjoy it.
And can people catch your 7:30 sketches on the web somewhere?
Absolutely. So you can follow me on Twitter at Mark Humphreys. Otherwise, I'm on Instagram at Humphreys Mark. Couldn't get Mark Humphreys.
Damn it.
And on Facebook at Mark Humphreys Comedy. Again, couldn't get Mark Humphreys.
It's better than having done like _Mark-Humphreys+.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's it. Yeah.
Well, wonderful to talk to you. I'll see you in Cancel Culture Jail, where we will both inevitably end up.
That's it. Thank you very much. Thank you, Josh.